I don't know their names, and I'm not looking for anyone, but now and then it's worth a look out the windows of the city and the skyline and the leather-soled rabble on the sidewalks below. We're on one of the hills, and only partway up. So if they've climbed this far, it's a good place to pause and take stock. Just a block down the hill, past the flowered trees and pretty coverings, it's miserably busy. Monster computer lanes are crammed and heaving, but here the steepness slows things. Traffic is at a minimum. People notice each other, heading down, climbing up, passing through our little crossroads to places less quiet. Across the hill's slope, three cottages squat side by side like burly brothers, one blue, one pink, one green. Ugly gray smoke streams from their front windows, a thick blanket that covers the first signs of flames. Every day, the three of them sit shoulder to shoulder, looking out over the city, unmoved by what they're seeing, indifferent, unimpressed. Until early this morning, when something must have snapped, something must have shifted, and they started to cook from the inside out. Now, together, they're going up in flames, burning into each other, and just so quickly, threatening the rest of the hill and the hundreds of houses packed close as family. Contiguous, brittle, kindling. Well, that's from the opening of Five Windows, a novel by John Raymer. It's a summer's day in contemporary San Francisco. Our protagonist is deep in his work on the second floor of his hillside old house condo. There's a sudden disturbance outside his bay window. You heard it. The hillside homes across from his home are engulfed in flames. Well, the fire department arrives. The fire is extinguished. And the renters, who had lived in the multi-story old homes, find themselves turned out into the street. What we think is going to be a mystery novel, because we kind of know that, that delves into the lives of the family displaced by fire becomes instead a tale of mystery and intrigue that slowly engulfs the entire gentrifying neighborhood, beginning anew with a frantic knock on our narrator's door just days after that fire. Our narrator opens his door to find his upstairs neighbor trembling on his doorstep, asking for our protagonist to call 911, as his husband is in dire medical straits. But then said neighbor distances himself from the narrator. When our narrator tries to follow up on his neighbor's husband's well-being a couple of days later. The soon-in-time announcement in the basement of the local library, no less, of a new transit center in their neighborhood causes an uproar among the neighbors of the Hillside District, unsettling nearly every resident, new, old, and sends a long-lasting quiver of anxiety throughout the neighborhood. Past social problems, as is perhaps natural, resurface in the minds as neighbors remind each other that their hood has never been without its challenges to a quiet life. There's that recently moved away teen who was a local drug dealer. The more than occasional police sirens and the blue tarpaulins that dot the neighborhood after house fires erupt and are extinguished. All of this comes together to leave both the reader, our author, and the hillside neighbors on edge as the pages push forward. At least halfway through the book, the feeling that something is not quite right here layers over, one could say infects, this story of day-to-day life in San Francisco's hillside neighborhood. Meanwhile, we are treated, in most every chapter, to our nameless narrator's continual search for unique, oddball, but potentially best-selling books for his small bi-coastal publishing company. The entire staff consists of our narrator, San Francisco, and two additional full-time employees, one with an office in New York City and one in St. Louis. Their latest book, a book about the spleen, has become something of a big hit on small book lists, and there's great hope that it will lead them to other best-selling oddball titles. As a publisher, our narrator has just the type of job that allows him to work from home and watch the world of San Francisco walk up and down from his second-story window, offering the narrator and us readers a look into daily life that his ex-wife and a few of his other neighbors don't get, for they are commuters in this modern urban world. And yet this stay-at-home-to-work life sets our narrator apart from these same neighbors in ways the neighbors in particular don't always appreciate. His supposed knowledge of the neighborhood is not the only reason, but it becomes a significant part of the anger that tears him and his wife's marriage apart. As we read, Sylvia used to hear me in St. Louis, and she'd roll her eyes and get off to work as fast as she could in the morning. "Seems real iffy," she'd tell me. She was impressed by none of my publishing work. "This whole thing you're doing feels like a colossal waste." "Wow," I told her as the front door slammed. I couldn't say what upset her so much. We'd agree things were changing too fast and too easily. The city was swelling. The streets were always clogging, and the skyline was getting pushed in alarming ways. Everything felt busier and infinitely more crowded, like there was more of everything crammed into the same space, but also like most of it was more of the same. More spick-and-span restaurants, more hand-woven hygge, more glass walls and living walls, and walls with tasteful retro super graphics. More buildings like ours were getting slick makeovers, and more new ones looked very much the same, with squared protrusions trying to mimic our bay windows, but with less breakable glass and special, pricey tints. More limited-run cars took up limited street parking, brazenly daring more glass breakage, too. More office workers on the sidewalk carried more pricey tote bags stamped with messages proclaiming more is always too much. Resistance had its own brand, its own signs of anti-consumption. I watched my wife Sylvie try to dress down, try to look inconspicuous, hyper-careful about her choices, her shoes and her watches, her bags and her scarves, convinced that understatement wasn't a statement, too. I thought of my work as a quiet sort of remedy, a growing stack of paperbacks that marked substantive alternatives, the standards that St. Louis cared so much about. I managed a workaround, a setup that protected me and allowed me to watch the rest through windows that were easy enough to replace. But now Sylvie was in it, one of the many walking downhill and back up at a pace I've never experienced myself. We shared gunfire and sirens. She accused me of secrets and unspoken agendas. We yelled and shouted and tore into each other before she finally left. 7 years later, she's come back to more changes, maybe finally catching up with them, finding what she needs right across the street. Well, the blurbs on the book tease us with references to Alfred Hitchcock. The director's classic Rear Window is not mentioned but clearly hinted at. And with our protagonist rooted in his second floor loft, gazing out his window when he's not working on his day job, at his urban neighbors whom he and we come to realize he hardly knows, despite their proximity, the connection to Rear Window becomes even stronger. And the mystery only thickens when our narrator's ex-wife, Sylvie, shows up in his life years after their estrangement for reasons that our protagonist can't quite parse out. Five Windows is as much a psychological thriller as it is a mystery. Is our protagonist really just imagining all the odd, off-kilter happenings in the world going on around him? Windows break in his condo. Stray gunfire is heard nearby. And by the time we reach the middle of the novel, as our hero, if you will, is relating the days as they go by, he lets us know he's taking painkillers. After falling down the stairs of his hillside building some pages before. And so in yet another shout-out to Rear Window, our protagonist finds himself restricted in his movement due to his injured knee. Yet he's able to continue his work at home and converse with both his online co-workers, St. Louis, New York City, and inquiring authors. Or is he? What gives? As our novel reaches its boiling point, our protagonist, our hero, our narrator, finds himself ditching his cross-country co-workers, much to their mounting dismay, as he is lured into the orbit of a clearly emotionally over-the-top, many say out of control, famous author, an author of bestsellers, who lauds our narrator with praise for his editorial skills and tempts him with vague promises of publishing the author's newest, and one is to suppose, a best-selling novel. Even as other editorial friends call and write to our protagonist, warning him that the famed author is no longer the famous and emotionally stable guy who built an empire of bestsellers, but the author's unassailable skill at flattery wins our story's narrator over, and our narrator pulls further and further away from the successful career he has built with his two fellow book publishers in their internet-fueled, if oddball, publishing business. Then the police call on our narrator at his home, asking if he's heard loud arguments from the couple upstairs. Has he heard and seen the small explosions, complete with wisps of smoke, from the newly remodeled condos across the street? Our narrator maintains his distance from the police's inquiries, claiming he's oblivious to the goings-on in the neighborhood. He tells us readers he so closely observes. So again, what gives? A reviewer at Kirkus Reviews wrote that this is a disquieting take on Rear Window. Set in contemporary San Francisco, like Hitchcock, Raymer excels at establishing and then deepening the reader's unease. But his interest is less in the plot complications that fuel Hitchcock's film than in the psychological drama unfolding within the apartment as the publisher's life implodes. End quote. In the end, Five Windows is an annoyingly compelling read. I found myself drawn into this confused mind of a lovable protagonist. I just wasn't able to put this novel down. So fair warning, start Five Windows at your own reading risk. And let me know what you find as you turn these pages. This is the author's first novel, we're told. I, for one, hope it's not his last. Let's finish with this moment near the apogee of our story, as our narrator is trying to come to terms with the uproar to our narrator's carefully crafted career and life caused by that best-selling author who is courting his editorial skills. Our author, at this point, has gotten just a little bit of cold feet and is not quite sure that he wants to follow this author as far as the author wants him to go as we join our story. He makes a big gesture, dropping his finger toward the keyboard, stopping the call and sending the screen blank. The video goes dark. I've got no more real answers. Then a message from Bram, the author, delivers our signed contract, followed by four or five anxious ones from other authors, cautioning me against going further. It's all too much. I have to catch my breath. And when I look out my window, there's just what I need. A remarkable thing to witness. A little boy skipping downhill, racing at full stride at a hair-raising pace. He's alone in the street in familiar-looking dance tights. The momentum is frightening. He's almost a blur. He looks like he's close to falling on his face, twisting an ankle, probably ripping his tights, and getting caught by whatever he's running from. I can feel it in my aching knee, what I'm thinking deep down. Go, boy, go. It comes from my bones. And a howl from my knee. Get where you're going. Get there fast. I push away from my desk, try to get myself down there, but I get double-crossed and end up nose-deep in delivery boxes. I reach for the brace, try to tighten the Velcro, but it's heavy and tangled. I'll go faster without it. My hideous, gnarled leg is still telling me so. At the vestibule, I consider pounding on my neighbor's door. But I have to steady myself and need to focus on the stairs. Apart from pudding with Lennon, this is as far as I've ventured in several days. By the time I'm on the sidewalk, the boy is long gone and I'm getting the sense I made a wrong turn. I try going back, but the maneuver is too much, and after a couple of corrective hops, I end up reeling backward onto the street, scraping both elbows against the pavement. The pain is blinding and universal, as if my full body were covered in flames. I roll onto my stomach and drag myself flat, with both legs limp behind me, aiming for the closest curb, the one with neon green graffiti, thinking Marlene and Max might be my best hope. I guess at the buzzers on their building. I don't know their last names. And the first one I try produces a woman who says, "Buzz me again, I'll call the police." The second informs me I'm recorded on video. "Got a real clear shot, buddy," the speaker reports. The next is Marlene, who releases the gate with a tasteful buzz. I can hear footsteps rushing down the stairs to meet me. When she gets me onto one foot, I remember she's much shorter, but she insists I lean on her. With an arm around my waist, she helps me to the top floor, step by step. I don't know what you're thinking, she says under her breath. She's trying not to upset me. I thought I told you to stay in bed. I've made a horrible mistake, I say. I just needed to get out. I'm about to explain more until I see where we're going, through a door that opens to a thick blanket of heat. A couple of small candles light the entry, and I can hear people laughing down the hallway. Onions and braised meats are cooking down there, as far as I can smell. And from what I can see, the walls are painted in muted earthy shades, with thick, shaggy rug art hanging at different levels. The place has the feel of a big bear hug. But Marlene gently turns me, guiding me in the opposite direction, away from the aroma and the conversations, toward a tidy bedroom and the edge of a bed. It's quite a read, I can assure you. It's, as I said, one that I wanted to put down so many times, and I just couldn't. I just had to keep turning these pages. Five Windows, a novel, a new novel, by John Raymer. It's quite a read, available at all of our fine local libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library.